I will call the meeting to order.
Check it out again.
And would anybody like to approve the minutes? Well, we don't have any minutes, so we don't have to do that. And the first bill up is House File 3087, Representative Faust. And since you're not a member of the committee, I will move that 3087 be before the committee. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. House File 3087 is allocating $625,000 to the Senior Congregate Dining Services in Minnesota. This is a program that has been cut from federal dollars. Federal dollars have funded this program since 1965. And because of the federal government sequestration, it was cut by about 7% or $500,000. So this is replacing some of the funding that was cut by the federal sequestration. Because of those cuts, there were just about three dozen senior congregate dining places that have been closed. And so this is a very important thing. This is not just about, you know, getting the meals for these seniors, but it's also about providing a place for them to get together and to visit and, you know, it's for many of them a main part of their daily lives and social lives as well. And so it's it does a lot more than just provide the nutrition that they need, but that is certainly a very important part of it. So so as many of you probably know, the estimates are that about 9.5% of all the seniors in Minnesota are food insecure, and that was even before the $500,000 cut of federal funding. And so so this is something that is extremely important. In full disclosure, I have to tell you that we just found out just less than half an hour ago that the federal government has restored the $500,000 to this program, which is good news. But even with that being the case, it doesn't do anything to eliminate that 9% or 9.5% of seniors that are insecure in their meals. And so, and there's also a growing demand for this, a significant growth in this as more baby boomers start to retire and become senior citizens. And so this is something that over the next 5, 10, 15 years is going to be a significant increase in demand. There's also a lot of increase in, we always refer to as meals on wheels, but bringing meals to the seniors that are still in their home that allows them to stay in their homes for a longer period of time. And a few years ago, I was out door knocking, and I came to a couple's place. In fact, this happened in two different places. And they both shared with me stories that, you know, they're choosing on a daily basis. Are they going to take their meds, or are they going to eat that day? And in Minnesota, we just hate to hear that kind of a story. It shouldn't happen. And this program helps prevent that from happening. So this is extremely important. I do have several testifiers, and I've got Jean Wood. And if she would like to come forward. And she can introduce herself. And you got a couple handouts, one that looks like this, and one that folds out, trifold, that are from her organization. So she will refer to both of those, I believe.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Jean Wood, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. In that role, I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging, which is a 25-member governor-appointed board that administers the Older Americans Act. And one of our largest services is the Congregate Meal and Home-Delivered Meal Programs. And in that program, annually, we deliver 2.7 million meals to 61,000 older Minnesotans all around the state. And this sequestration has had very much an effect on the programs. Representative Faust did discuss one of the biggest impacts was starting January 1. We did have to close 35 congregate meal sites in order to fund all the rest of the programs that we needed to fund in nutrition. And so With the addition of these funds, again, as he explained, the federal government did notify us late last week that they were able to restore most of the funds that were cut in the sequestration due to an action by Congress. But we also know that we have been cut and that in future years there will be more and more demand, particularly in home-delivered meals. And so if this funding were to prevail, the board would use this money to strengthen the nutrition program and be able to grow it in future years for future demand.
Any questions for Ms. Wood? I don't see any. So, do you have another testifier?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Robert Zeski was not able to attend, but Ms. Gauthier is here in her place.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greta Gauthier, and I am with Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank. We operate here out of the Twin Cities and serve over 1,000 food shelves and meal programs in 41 counties in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to testify in support of House File 3087. Senior hunger is a growing issue in Minnesota. It's the fastest growing group of hungry people in Minnesota. Particularly, we are seeing an increase in the younger seniors coming to our food shelves that we supply. Seniors who are age 60 to 70 are more likely to be food insecure than seniors who are over age 80. And many of those younger seniors have been adversely impacted by the economic downturn that we all experienced in 08 and 09, and many of them have not been able to recoup the earning level that they had prior to that downturn. So about a third of them are reporting, the ones that come to food shelves are reporting that they do have to choose between a home heating bill and food, or they have to choose between medicine and food. So overall, we've seen a greater than 70% increase in senior visits to food shelves that we serve since 2008. The National Council on Aging reports that 60% of the seniors who use congregate dining report that the food they consume there is more than half of the calories they have for that day. We're very interested in the intersection of hunger and health, Mr. Chairman, and there is a letter for the members of the committee from our Chief Executive Officer, Rob Zeski, who I apologize could not be here today. But there are some new findings from a national study by Feeding America, which is the National Association of Food Banks, showing that food insecure seniors are 53% more likely to report a heart attack, 52% more likely to develop asthma, 40% more likely to report congestive heart failure, and 60% more likely to experience depression. So knowing that our health care costs are what they are, we feel that even though we're very grateful to have learned just today that the sequestration cuts were restored, those same sequestration cuts will be up on the block again in Washington for the next federal fiscal year. And the federal Congress has not reauthorized the Older Americans Act, which was up for reauthorization in 2011, so that's hanging out there as well. And given the impact on senior health, we feel that this money towards senior congregate dining would be extremely well spent in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Gauthier? Don't say anything. Thank you for your testimony.
One more.
LSS.
Yep, I'll be quick. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susie Schatz. I'm from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. And about 20 of the 35 senior nutrition sites mentioned were our senior nutrition sites that needed to close or make some major adjustments in service. And so I just wanted to speak to the challenge that of course, brings to those communities that are all very, very rural communities without a whole lot of options. We are doing our best to innovate in those communities, serving frozen meals weekly when possible, working with restaurants to be able to provide provide the service. And we worked really closely with the MBA and the AAAs in those areas to be able to find solutions for the seniors who their dining opportunities were changing. If I could just reinforce that senior nutrition is really a lifeline for folks. We have so many stories of people that have volunteers that have gone and knocked on the doors of older adults and been the ones to find them when they fell the day before, or be the person who, the only person that that older adult may see on a weekly basis. So we really just can't reinforce that enough, and the fact that sometimes all that person needs is a hot, nutritious meal once a day, and that will keep them healthier and in their homes for longer, saving us lots of money on the institutional care side. So thank you.
Are there other testifiers, Representative Paulson?
Nope, that's all I have.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Were you going to ask, are there any questions for the author?
Sure.
Okay. I didn't want to be...
You're ahead of me.
So just a question, Representative Faust, it says on the bottom, or I'm just looking at the data, that this is going to appropriate, $625,000 for 2015. What is the budget now on the do you have a fiscal note, or what is the budget now that we appropriate for this program?
Thank you. I don't believe that there's any state money going into it at all now. It's all been all federal money. And that was a cut of 7% of their total, so their total would be how much? Oh, I'm sorry. There is about $2 million in state money, I guess. I just found out. The total budget is. I should refer to the expert here on the numbers.
Wood.
Before I say more than I know.
Yeah. Thank you again. I'm Jean Wood with the Department of Human Services. The meals program runs on federal, state, and local funds. Local individuals also can donate to this, and there is support from local organizations. And it is roughly around $12 million altogether. And again, that's for 2.7 million meals going to 61,000 older Minnesotans.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. What is that number again? I'm sorry, Jean.
I'd say it's about 12 million. And I can get you the exact figures, but when we do public speaking, we speak in terms of about a $12 million program. It's our second largest program.
Representative
McDonald.
Chairman, thank you. So then this appropriation is asking for $625,000. Will that be added to the base then, Representative Faust?
I'd have to say I don't know. No, it's just one time.
And then lastly, Mr. Chairman.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Representative Faust, when I got elected, we were in the majority then in the fiscal note. You guys always, the minority, always asked for fiscal note. Oh, my gosh, that's all I ever heard. And we were, I felt like we were not behaving. We weren't following proper procedure, not following fiscal notes. And, boys, that was very helpful. Last year, or when we were in the majority, to offer a fiscal note. I almost read the fiscal note first and then the bill, and I'm seeing a lot of bills coming through many committees, hardly any fiscal notes. And I'm just curious why you wouldn't provide a fiscal note for our gratification in supporting your bill.
Mr. McDonald, this is an appropriation, so we don't get a fiscal note on something that's simply an appropriation.
Well, there's the answer.
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the bill is the fiscal note. It appropriates $625,000 one time, period.
Well, there you go. Another lesson learned. Thank you. Thank you, Doug and Mr. Chairman.
Are there other questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it might be Ms. Wood. In the supplemental budgets, I noticed there was $1.5 million for... I believe Second Harvest out of the ag finance area. Does that augment, or will any of that be available to the same program?
Ms. Wood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, no, it will not. And I would maybe call on Second Harvest to talk about that.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greta Gauthier, Second Harvest Heartland. Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, that bill is the Farm to Food Shelf bill, and that bill will help to move currently unharvested vegetables and fruits grown by Minnesota farmers to local food shelves. So it will assist in getting more fresh, healthy food to food shelves. But and so in that sense, if a senior is going to a food shelf, they would have access to that. But it will not be supplying, I shouldn't say that. In many cases, actually, we do supply meal programs around the state with food. So I would have to get back to you on exact numbers on that. But we supply over 1,000 food shelves and meal programs, and those do include some congregate dining programs. It varies by county. Some counties have a food shelf that does that. Other counties have other systems for distributing food that comes into the food shelves. But this would not be directly for congregate dining. It is for food shelves.
Representative Quam.
Thank you.
Other questions? I don't see any, and I just have a final. Well, I'll let you finish off, but before you get to your comment about door knocking, just brought back to one of my observations, and that's one thing. Everybody that's door knocked has seen seniors come to the door, and you wonder, oh my God, I hope their son or daughter lives next door because they should not be there alone. And we've seen lots of that when you go door knocking. So, Representative Faust, you want to finish up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I started out by saying that this helps provide the nutrition that a lot of our seniors need, but it provides a lot more than that. It provides a place for them to get together, to socialize, to meet. But it also helps keep a lot of older adults in their homes for a lot longer period of time. And so, you know, when you look at that and you know, how many would have to move into the nursing homes before it would cost us more money, not less money. And so these programs are not just good for the seniors, but they're good investment for the state of Minnesota as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Representative Faust. And so I would move that House File 3087 be laid over for possible inclusion. And next, where are we going? Representative Halverson's House File 2203. Okay. We'll do Abler next. He had to go someplace and he's coming back.
Makes sense.
Hi. Do you want to move your bill?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2203 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I also have an amendment that I'd like to move.
Okay. Would you... How big is the amendment?
It's small. It's a language change. It should be included in your packet. The language change just makes it clear that it's added to the base funding. It was a recommendation that research made.
Okay.
So that we make the language more clear.
Representative Halverson will just include the error. Oh, we have to vote? Okay. So she's moved the... 814-0948 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment is adopted. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the bill before us today will look familiar because we did discuss the Homeless Youth Act last session. Back in 2006, the House of Representatives, or excuse me, the state of Minnesota passed the Homeless Youth Act. And at the time, based on studies from the Department of Human Services, the recommended request was $8 million to fund grants for programs that serve and prevent youth homelessness in Minnesota. Since that time, the appropriation has been about $500,000 per biennium, so it's been severely underfunded. In the meantime, the need has continued to grow as pressures on our economy have changed the living situations for a lot of people. And we heard from a lot of youth last year, and it became very clear to me as the author and to everybody here, I know, that this isn't an issue that was about regions of the state. It happens everywhere in the state. It wasn't a partisan issue. It had broad bipartisan support. That this money is really about prevention. We heard yesterday from the folks regarding the Safe Harbors Act, and they mentioned, and rightfully so, that this is really upstream prevention, because the kids who face homelessness are, one, leaving situations where they are in danger, where somebody has let them down, where they may be facing abuse, where they may be facing neglect. And they're making a strong and choice to put themselves out on the streets. And the thought that you're going to leave a safe, a home environment for the streets is I think, illustrative of how dangerous these situations are. And when they get out on the streets, they're at risk for, as we heard, trafficking. They're also at risk for being crime victims in other ways. They may be at risk for becoming part of the criminal justice system. They're certainly at risk for lifelong homelessness, and they're at risk for never graduating from high school or never getting their first job or never getting to go to college. These programs stop that trend and put these kids on a path to prosperity. So I've got a hearty thank you for everybody who supported the $4 million appropriation that was requested of the $8 million that we asked for. And we're back before you today because those grants have been distributed, that $4 million. And although $4 million were distributed, the Department of Human Services actually received 51 requests totaling $20 million. Of that $20 million, they determined that there was $10 million worth of grant requests that were for programs that were ready to go, that were already serving youth, that were underfunded, that if they were funded could reach many more kids. And so that's why I come back before you today to ask for the an additional $4 million to the base appropriation. And I'm here with a number of partners, and so I would like to introduce Susie Schatz at this time from Lutheran Social Services, who can tell you more.
Welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Susie Schatz. I'm from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, and I'm also here representing Youth Moving Forward, which is a large coalition of homeless youth providers and advocates from across the state. We've been working on the Homeless Youth Act as Youth Moving Forward since 2006, and so we are very grateful for the attention that you paid last year to homeless youth, and as you recall, that was a big jump from the previous amount of funding that was included. Many of you were co-authors last year and this year, and we are so appreciative of the support that you provided. Just briefly, the handouts that are in front of you, the first one is a list of the awardees and their location. And as Representative Halverson mentioned, most of these applicants were not funded nearly to their request, and there are, of course, lots of folks who are not on that list who were not funded at all. The second is a summary of our what has happened up until this point with the Homeless Youth Act and some key points from Wilder about what some new research around homeless youth, and then details about our request this session. Brian Pittman from Wilder Research is here, along with Megan Bowman and Jennifer Erdman from Lakes and Pines Community Action, and we also have a young person from Avenues for Youth here to speak as well, and they'll be covering about some of the challenging circumstances and what we've learned, and then some specifics around Greater Minnesota.
Thank you. Mr. Pittman.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Brian Pittman, and I'm one of the researchers responsible for conducting the statewide study of homelessness every 3 years in the state of Minnesota. I'm representing Wilder Research today, which is distinct from the program and policy arms of the Wilder Foundation. The statewide study of homelessness is now in its eighth cycle. Data collected was last collected in October of 2012. Study data includes both single night counts of all persons staying in shelters or other time-limited housing programs, as well as a face-to-face survey of nearly half the population we identify. This work was carried out in 2012 by more than 1,200 volunteers who went out across the state of Minnesota to more than 350 sites, including outreach sites like feeding and day centers, as well as places not intended for habitation. A few key facts from the study. We counted a total of 10,214 individuals who were homeless on the night of October 25th, 2012. This represents about a 6% increase in the numbers identified in the 2009 survey. Of this number, 1,151 were young people, age 21 or younger, and nearly 150 were unaccompanied minors under age 18. An additional 3,546 were children under the age of 18 who were accompanying their homeless parents. We know that this number, 1,151 youth and young adults who are on their own, is not a complete count of the total homeless youth population. And in fact, we know that the homeless youth population is the hardest to count because of a couple key factors. First, there are fewer emergency shelter beds available to homeless youth. Second, the homeless youth are more likely to seek shelter from a friend or another family. And third, homeless youth have often been exploited or exposed to violence, and many have had other traumatic experiences in their backgrounds. Despite this, we've made an attempt to estimate the actual number of total youth and young adults who are likely to be homeless on a single night in Minnesota. And through these calculations, we have estimated that number to be just over 4,000. The estimating procedures that we used have been updated since 2009. We now use an estimate that's based on population incidence and combined with our survey data rather than simply a multiplier factor based on our shelter counts. This change has helped us to account for more of the hidden homeless youth, especially those who may not be connected to formal services. And I'd like to share an additional few facts with you to consider in front of these proposals. When we look at the entire age group of those 21 and younger in the homeless youth population, the typical age of entry into homelessness is 17. For those 18 and younger, or under 18, that typical age is 15. And when we look at the entire study group, including homeless adults, entry into homelessness is most common at ages 16, 17, and 18 years old. Roughly 54% of all homeless youth in the Twin Cities and 65% of homeless youth in Greater Minnesota have spent some time in some form of out-of-home placement, including about 40% who had spent some time in foster care. 60% of all homeless youth have had at least one parent who has been incarcerated. Half of all homeless youth have a severe or persistent mental health issue. 44% of homeless youth have been physically abused as children, 27% have been sexually abused, and 31% have been neglected. And when you take all three of these together, about over one half of homeless youth have had one of those types of maltreatment. Significant racial disparities also exist in the homeless youth population. Approximately half of the metro area homeless youth population is African American. And in Greater Minnesota, about one in five homeless youth are American Indian. Most of our homeless youth population is homegrown. 76% of the homeless youth population grew up in Minnesota. And 15% of youth identified as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or were unsure about their sexual identity. And also 2% identified as transgender. Overall, 29% of youth are parents themselves, and this includes 39% of female homeless youth who are parents. And nearly one quarter of youth show evidence of traumatic brain injury. Yet, despite all these factors and these numbers that I just stated, these youth are incredibly resilient. Most youth are enrolled in school. 95% of minors are enrolled. And 7 out of 10 youth had attended school on the day of the survey. Among those youth who are 19 and older, 58% had completed high school, and 31% of youth had some type of employment when they were interviewed, and this is actually higher than the adult rate of employment in the homeless population. And all of this, of course, represents kind of simply the statistics that frame this issue and not the faces or story of the youth themselves. But I thank you for the attention you're giving to this matter, and I would be happy to take any questions if you have them.
Any questions for Mr. Pittman? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pittman, I was surprised that the 29% are parents. And what does that say about the rest of our safety net that you could advise us on?
Mr. Pittman.
I don't know what it says about the safety net, but I can say that 20% of the children or 20% of the homeless youth had the children with them, so some of them did not have the children with them.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Pittman. Looking at the grants, it doesn't necessarily follow, you know, the outstate where the population, largest population center, is having more, or is it because of not granting? I mean, because I noticed Rochester, there are five cities in greater Minnesota that are smaller for a combined 11 times the funding. Is it there's a lack of homeless youth in the Rochester area, or is it a lack of programs?
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I think that we should ask the department to answer that question. It's a very good question.
Mr. Chair, I thought Mr. Pittman and the Wilder Group did a study to look at, and so I'm trying to understand the results and the granularity of their study to see what the greater Minnesota effects were that came out of their study. I mean, if the department wishes to augment that with additional information, but it's I like having the, you know, the outside source from the study.
Mr. Pittman.
Could I get the question again, please?
Mr. Chair, analyzing the grants, I noticed that they aren't following the population centers outside the metro in proportionality because of, you know, there are some cities that are quite a bit less. They're receiving, you know, 2.5 or 4 times the funding than Rochester. Is it because there's less of a homeless problem in Rochester that we have regional differences or effects that are causing? I'd like to understand more on greater Minnesota what your study showed for concentrations and factors.
Mr. Pittman.
Well, I do know that at the breakdown of youth numbers is about 60-40 metro area to greater Minnesota. I'm not sure about the distribution of the funds. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so I assume the answer is they don't have granularity for the different areas of greater Minnesota. So outside the metro, it's one bucket.
He may, there may be in their data, but he's not aware of what the answer would be right now.
Yes, I don't have that in front of me right now, but we do provide the data down to the individual continuum of care region.
So if you could get Representative Kwan's questions about Rochester, that would be helpful.
I will do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because it's not Rochester's an easy one because it's a large, but there may be factors with the economies in different parts of the state that we need to take into account. And I know the Iron Range has different, you know, seasonal employment that might have an effect. And so I think if we're looking at these programs, it might be nice to have the additional information.
Well, I know Rochester has a fairly high population of Somalis, and be interesting to see what their thing. In my city, we have a very high population of American Indians that are, in many cases, also homeless. And in the case of Duluth, a lot of the young Indian girls are being trafficked. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Pittman on the a couple things. One on the drop-in centers. I know we have one in Anoka, but the children have to be out of the drop-in centers by a certain time in the evening. They can't stay overnight. So on the other areas where you indicate there's a drop-in center, or maybe this is Representative Halverson, it says drop-in center and traditional transitional housing. Is that something that's simultaneous? If they drop in, do they get into transitional housing right away? Do they have something else, or you know, is this a process that has to be taken? And I have one other question, actually, for Mr. Right. Pittman. For those youth who have children with them, do any of these 30 facilities, or all of them, are they capable of accommodating the accompanying children with the families?
Mr. Pittman.
I'm not sure about that, but I can get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Other questions?
I think the other testifiers are going to be able to answer those questions, because I think the questions are coming to the grants and to the actual services provided, as opposed to study data about what youth homelessness in Minnesota kind of looks like from a research perspective. So.
Okay. Should we move on to the other speakers? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Deb Loon. I'm the Executive Director of Avenues for Homeless Youth. It's an honor to be here, and we thank you for your attention to this important issue. I just would like to make a couple of brief comments. First, to thank Representative Halverson and the co-authors for your leadership on this. We have a tremendous need and opportunity in the state of Minnesota in supporting young people who experience homelessness. The best part of my job every single day is watching these young people move from a crisis situation onto stabilizing and building hope for their future and going after their goals. It's a real honor to work with them. Avenues operates a shelter and transitional housing program here in Minneapolis. We also operate three host home programs, and we are in the process of working very hard to develop a new program in the suburbs, in this case Brooklyn Park, working with the Northwestern suburban communities. And we did get a grant through the appropriation last year that will provide about 15% of the budget for that program. It's very important starting place for us, which we will leverage and are working very hard to make come true. I have a wonderful young man with me today who will talk about his experience, and his name is Jeremiah Carter.
Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Chairman? Avenues has changed my life, you know. You know, when I was, Jeremiah Carter. You know, when I was 19 and a half, going on 20, you know, it wasn't really a problem at my home. You know, it was just I wanted to go out and be independent. And nobody in my community, you know, taught me how to be independent out, you know, in the community. So, I went to Avenues, and, you know, there was some really good staff there. You know, I got my GED. They helped me get my GED because, you know, I was going down the wrong path. I was hanging out with wrong people. You know, the people I will go spend the night, I'll go spend the night at their house, you know. It'll be, you know, a bad surrounding. So, as me going there, it was like, you know, I had shelter. I had time to think. And my temptations were very low because, you know, I was surrounded by, you know, good people and people that wanted to go on the right path. So, yeah, I got my GED. I'm in school now, going for business and management. And I'm a little bit of nervous up here, but don't mind that. You know, I got, you know, I try to. But, yeah, you know.
Most of us are pretty friendly here.
Yeah. You know, and.
He said most of us.
And, you know.
Look at that Grunhagen, though.
And, you know, another thing I like about Avenues is they stay in touch with you, you know. They'll, you know, I'm 22 now. I was there when I was 20. You know, I know it's for the youth, you know, before you're 21. But, you know, they stay in touch with you, you know. They make sure you're doing good. They'll have coffee with you, you know, and, you know, they'll follow up with you. And, it changed my life. I mean, it changed my life, you know. So, yeah, I really like it.
So. Well, they helped you change your own life.
Yeah, pretty much. Helped me change my own life. That was, yeah.
Any questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that we're just glad to have you here. You did a great job, and, you know, thanks so much for coming down. And you really, I think you made us all smile today just because you're so enthusiastic, and that's nice to have on a day like today.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and thanks for coming, too. I appreciate that. And I should disclose, I'm involved with Hope for Youth, and I know I happen to be the landlord there, and we have a below-market deal with them, and I didn't realize they were a grantee until I saw the list. But there's every one of these places has gentlemen like this and women that come forward with remarkable and you can, it's just been impressive to see, and a lot of, mostly our places, volunteers, I think they have one or two staff, but it's, we have about 200 volunteers or something at ours. And these people just love to come, and they get to hook up with, you know, gentlemen and women, and they become their friends and become their mentors, and it's remarkable how the lives do get changed, and you get upstream in the pipeline, and then bad things don't happen to these individuals, and it changes everything. So it's so good for all of you carrying this bill and all the workers. It's thanks.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as Representative Liebling said, I too just want to thank you so much for coming and sharing your stories, because it's really important, I think, for myself and all of us, that when we invest in something that we know creates better outcomes, it's good to hear stories how our investment has touched real people's lives. So just continue to do what you do, and to know that it's great to have good people around you to help you help yourself. We all need that type of support at some time in our lives. And just want to thank Lori, Representative Harrison, for bringing this bill forth and helping us to see the need to invest early now, because if we don't, we definitely always see it later on the end. So thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank
you.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we have one more. Jennifer Erdman. So welcome to the committee, and would you introduce yourselves?
Yes. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. I am Jennifer Erdman with Lakes and Pines Community Action. We serve at-risk homeless youth as well as the other populations. We were a recipient of the HYA funding. We received funding to implement host home programs in East Central, Northeast Minnesota, and we also received funding for transitional housing for homeless youth. We serve in an area that virtually has no services, no homeless shelters for youth. We have a adult shelter in Pine City, and we have a family shelter in Cambridge, Minnesota. So when we received the Homeless Youth Act funding, we were grateful, very thankful. There's definitely a need. And to that end, I'll let Megan Bowman kind of share with you. She works with our youth directly, and she's got some information that would help.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Megan Bowman. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Megan Bowman. I work as a community service advocate working with at-risk and homeless youth for Lakes and Pines, located in Mora. We work with seven different counties: Aiken, Carlton, Chisago, Isani, Kennebec, Mille Lacs, and Pine. The transitional HYA youth funding that we received this year has been a blessing and has made dreams become reality for many of the teens in our communities. Finding affordable housing is a consistent issue and daily struggle for many people, but especially for the youth with no prior credit histories, as well as being youth with low income, and more often than not, they are raising children as well as trying to raise themselves. Many of the youth population that I have come into contact with have reported that they have stayed in the following places for shelter: vehicles, bathrooms, relatives, friends, hospitals, campgrounds, couch hopping, Walmart parking lots, and college parking lots. These young These young youth need some support, guidance, and a voice. One young couple that I am specifically working with got married at the age of 18. They have a small infant and are living on their own for the first time. One parent working and the mother staying home to care for their son. They were struggling in all their life areas and did not know how to turn or where to turn to get their feet back on the ground and be responsible parents. They began working with me in 2013, requesting financial assistance to help pay for their rent, to which they fell 3 months behind. They were on the verge of eviction and felt like they would never get out of the debt that they had fell so fast into. Through the HYA program, I was able to work with them, get them caught up on their rent, prevent eviction and homelessness, as well as to help them acknowledge other areas of their life that they wanted to work on to be healthier for themselves, as well as to build a stronger family unit. They were very afraid of losing their housing, having enough money to eat, wanting to finish high school, and then further going on to college, learning to cook and other life skills, pay their bills on time and always pay their rent first, learn needs versus wants and how to save for an emergency fund. These clients have set goals around each of the above areas that I have discussed and successfully accomplished each one of them and are now debt-free. They are ahead on their rent. They buy food each month, have an emergency fund, as well as a savings account that they have now built for their son, and now are working on their education as well as saving and taking steps necessary now to purchase their first home. Thank you.
Okay. Very good story. Any questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looks like Lutheran Social Services is back.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Schatz can certainly answer Representative Newton's question if we wanted to loop back to some of the services for the folks who are parents, or if there are other questions of the committee, Ms. Schatz is available to answer about what kind of programs are.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. So, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, not for the testifier, but for Representative Helmerson. Again, I'm going to hammer on the fiscal note. You know, a fiscal note is, in state statute, the Minnesota Management Budget, supposed to provide a fiscal note for us for any bill or legislation that allocates appropriations. And if I find it, and I'm sure, I hope that my colleagues find it very helpful in determining the bill. But for those who don't know in the room, a fiscal note estimates the costs, savings, and the revenues or loss resulting from this legislation. And I just think it's very important that, Representative, that if a fiscal note is deemed necessary and by state statutes appropriate, and according to our fiscal analysis, Doug Burke, it is, it's in the Senate version, it's not in the House version, we should have it. It's important for us lawmakers to know, have a guidance, know where we have been, where we are now, and where we're going. So please, folks, if you're not bringing a fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, I can't imagine why you wouldn't require one. You certainly did when we were in the majority, and I think, I don't know why you wouldn't have that as a guide before every bill that allocates money going forward.
Doug Berg, you could respond.
Mr. Chairman and members, there is in fact a fiscal note on this bill. On the Senate version of this bill, there was some slight miscommunication between Ms. Morgan and myself about that, and it's not in front of you. I will make sure it gets distributed to the members as soon as committee is done. The bills are identical. The Senate fiscal note shows a net cost in addition to the $4 million appropriation of $75,000 for a staff position and administrative costs to distribute this. It shows those costs in fiscal 15, and then since this is permanent money in each year, 16 and 17 in the tails. I will comment that this bill, in fact, I don't think state statute, if you read it carefully, requires that every bill that make an appropriation be have a fiscal note, because this bill, in fact, shows what the cost of it is. If we pass this bill, it costs $4 million. It does not cost $4,075,000. There is an issue which comes up frequently in this committee about administrative costs for programs. At some point, DHS must have communicated to the Senate author or to the Senate fiscal analyst that they'd like to comment that they needed a staff position to handle this. I have not had such a communication, but there is a Senate fiscal note that shows they would like that. Those costs, this is a tricky thing, but those costs are discretionary on the part of the legislature. Sometimes we fund them, sometimes we don't. In the case of this bill, if it passes as it is in front of you, it would cost $4 million. It would not cost $4,075,000. And that practice has been uniform under majorities of both bodies. And I think Chairman Abler, or former Chairman Abler, can tell you of numerous occasions where he did not recognize administrative costs.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. On the merits of the bill, please don't please recognize that this is no indication of your bill, Representative Halverson. This is a worthy cause, and I appreciate Ms. Schatz to your documents that you passed out indicating each and every dollar and the helpful how helpful it was, and Mr. Carter's testimony as well is very worthy and has my support in general. But as important as a job as mine as an elected official to ask the questions and to seek the guidance when any money is distributed on an annual basis. So I thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Halverson, and we certainly look forward to continued success. But we do need, I think it's important that we have fiscal notes from going forward.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. And this kind of goes a little bit to the question that Representative Newton was asking earlier about children who've got young children with them. First of all, as disclosure, I work at Avenues for Homeless Youth, so I take care of working on our licensing, etc. And one of the things, we're licensed by the Department of Health and Human Services, and we're only allowed to have youth between the ages of 16 and 21. So as a result, by our license, we can't allow to have anyone in our facility who have got youth with them. And that might be one of the things taking a look down the road is how do those things have an impact, particularly when you want to provide services to youth who are in those difficult situations. How do we look at licensing and having an impact on that, and what can we do in terms of creating supportive services so we're meeting the licensing but at the same time not having it as a potential barrier?
Thank you, Representative Fisher. I appreciate that. One of my concerns is with this facility is that we have in Anoka, and it might be more pervasive than just our local area, is that the youth will go to the facility, but they have to be out by a certain time in the evening. They can't stay overnight. So I know of three children who are sleeping in cars at the parking lot at Coon Rapids High School. They've been there for months. And I guess one of my fears is for many of the kids who do go to the shelter, they're there during the day. Evening, they don't have a place to go. They migrate to Minneapolis or St. Paul thinking that they might find something. And they're exposing themselves to being exploited even more than they are in our community. So, you know, I'm just concerned about this transition from for those types of shelters to make sure we get them into some housing. And then it's that they're able to stay in that facility long enough to really get on their feet as the young lady was talking about her program. So if you could address that, please, Ms. Schatz.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newton, as your first question asked about the kind of connection between drop-in centers and transitional housing, and as you look at that list of services that have been funded, they don't all list, you know, drop-in and transitional housing. The Homeless Youth Act covers the drop-in centers, transitional housing, shelter, and street outreach. And so youth can enter in on any place in that continuum, absolutely. You may recall in early January when temperatures were negative 20, negative, you know, 30, horrible temperatures. Some, I think maybe one or two drop-in centers in Minneapolis were able to remain open overnight to allow young people to stay. But that speaks to the absolute problem that we're here addressing today. Oftentimes, young people may ride the bus all night to stay out of the weather. If you can imagine a teenager on the city bus, they may stay in all of those places. We have a family in Brainerd, a young family sleeping in a van in a parking lot through those terrible temperatures. You know, as Megan mentioned, just about anywhere. So young people sleeping in fish houses, things like that. And then, so that's exactly what we're here to address today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have to move on because we have three more bills to go, and that's 10 minutes apiece. So this bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Halverson. As amended. Representative Abler, House File 3071.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move a House File 3071 that you'd find the money for it. And I know the pressure's on you, Mr. Chair, so we're just here in a friendly way to point out the great idea.
So Representative Abler has moved his bill before the committee.
Possible inclusion, yeah. Rats. Just thought I'd give it a shot, Mr. Chair. Community health clinics are well known to this committee, and they're well known to the communities that they serve. They do an incredible job on a shoestring. And talking about fiscal notes and trying to get stuff done, we tried under my tenure, and you tried under yours, to do something about the emergency medical assistance population, which falls through a lot of cracks, and bad things happen to those folks. We serve them in emergency rooms, and so it made sense that we could get upstream on some of that. We might actually change a few lives. There's a large proposal of $38 million, which obviously no one's going to buy this year, but it strikes me that if you could throw a little more money at these groups here and help them serve the very individuals that we're after, that would make a lot of sense. And so that's what's behind my mind and in my conception of this $2 million appropriation. And so I know time is a little light, so I wanted to turn my testifiers to talk to you.
Do you want to move your amendment?
Oh, well, that's a different topic. So let's do this, and then we'll pick that up at the end. It's a whole different, related, very important topic, but not to this bit, Mr. Chair. So,
okay. Mr. Watson.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, and you do have a handout in your packet, and I'm not going to go through it, but it really explains the demographics of who the 17 FQHCs in the state of Minnesota do serve. Since 2007, we've been partnering with the state of Minnesota with the Community Health Center appropriation that right now is at $2.3 million, and per statute, it is to continue to expand and improve FQHC services to low-income populations. We do understand 2014 is not a budget year, and you have some pretty tight targets over here in the House, but nonetheless, we do feel strongly these dollars really go far at the community level. For the current appropriation, what we spend it on is partially offsetting the care to the uninsured, which totaled $38 million for 70,000 individuals last year, but we also use it for other investments we make into the health center in terms of expanding access, investments in information technology so we can care coordinate. But probably what you're interested in is what we would spend an increase on, and we've really prioritized four areas amongst our community health centers. First and foremost is eliminating healthcare disparities. Examples of that would be expanding patient outreach activity, retaining healthcare home certification, and additional case management staff. The second area would be increased care coordination. There's some IT investments that need to be made so we can begin to approach some interoperability with our safety net partners. The third area is ER room diversion, emergency room diversion. So adding weekend and evening hours at the community health centers, some of these dollars could go for that. And then lastly, access to oral health. That continues to be a crisis in the state, and we actually do have a proposal embedded in this ask to really have a new dental building at one of our community health centers. So really the overriding theme of the community health center model is increasing access for primary care in a cost-effective way to really reduce the health care costs overall. You probably don't want to hear much from me anymore, so I brought Deanna Mills along here today. She's the CEO of the Community University Healthcare Center in Minneapolis. So,
welcome to the committee. And I heard this facility, and it was very interesting, particularly from a nursing and healthcare and medical education point of view.
Yes, thank you for visiting us last fall, too. We appreciate it. My name is Deanna Mills, and first of all, I want to say happy spring. It is spring in like a half an hour. No boots today. So my name is Deanna Mills, and I'm the director of the Community University Healthcare Center, which is a department of the University of Minnesota. And we're located in South Minneapolis in the heart of the Phillips neighborhood, if you're familiar with that area. And we began in 1966 when the community came to us and said, or actually to the medical school of the university, and said, we've got a big problem with infant mortality, and can you help us? And so hence the clinic started about 50 years ago to address infant mortality. But today, we're a comprehensive clinic. We're a one-stop shop. We provide medical care, dental care, and a very significant mental health program. In addition to that, we have many enabling services, we call them. I don't know what you call them, but it's like pro bono legal services, advocacy services, enrollment into programs, outreach, various other community-based type organization functions. We serve about 11,000 people every year. And we have, they make about 65,000 health care visit encounters with us. And even though we're located in the Phillips neighborhood, about 80% of our patients come from the whole of Hennepin County, and other people come as far away as Gaylord, Minnesota, Albertville, Minnesota, and all parts of Ramsey County. And I liken that to the fact that there's a shortage of psychiatry services in this community, and they come from far away to receive our psychiatry services. And as you can imagine, as part of the university, and Representative Huntley said, we have about 300 students and residents that come through our clinic, and so we're training them for the future. So COOC, like all FQHCs and all healthcare providers in the state of Minnesota, are really at the crossroads right now. As we begin to increase people who have insurance and have access to healthcare systems, we're overjoyed about that. But we already know that that's only the first step because we've got a healthcare system that has still significant problems. So we have, at the FQHC clinics and COOC, we've been working for several years to rebuild our care model, and we have a very absolutely Representative Huntley was exposed to that for a three-hour visit. We've been building that model over 2 years so that we can begin to address the care coordination needs of our patients. The other thing that we're part of is a couple years ago there was legislation passed. It was called the HCDS at that point in time. I think it's called IHP now, Integrated Health Project. It's the demo, the Medicaid demonstration projects, and we're one of 10 clinics that are in the FUN project. That's FUN with an H, F-U-H-N, which stands for the Federally Qualified Healthcare Centers Urban Health Network. And our goal is fairly unique in all these HCDSs because we're the only virtual network, and we're the only entirely network made up of safety net clinics. And we're 2 years into this right now, and we're showing some preliminary good results, so we're kind of excited about that. But it's based on the premise of elevating primary care, which is a really cost-effective method. And as Representative Abler said, we spread a penny really far in our clinics. So So we actually call, many of you might be familiar with the triple aim, but we say it's triple aim plus one, and that is the elevating of primary care as the cost-effective method to reduce total cost of care. So we're beginning our second year, and we have been building our care model, and specifically through trying to decrease the total cost of care. We also have been trying to improve quality specifically by addressing health disparities or the social determinants of health, and we have been very active engaging our patients to, as you said earlier to Jeremiah, to improve his own life, and that is what we're doing with our patients as well. And Representative Huntley, Representative McDonald, I want to take your attention to my fiscal note. So I'm a spreadsheet queen at our clinic because I have to put together the budget every year. And so if you have in your packet, it may not be color for you, but it's color for me here. So we've put together a care model over the past couple years where we have a series of nurses who their roles have been completely redone over the past couple years. We put some social workers on our case because social determinants of health require social workers. We put community health workers in place because we need to get out into the community. We can't always get people to come into the clinic. And we have, unfortunately, two advocates because we have a high, as you've heard in previous testimony, incidence of domestic abuse and sexual violence in our community. So we are approaching it both from the medical perspective as well as the social determinants of health. But that takes money to get these, to redo the care model in our clinics. So you can see when I'm looking at my budget for next year, I have about $866,000 worth of care model, and not one of these people are going to bill for service. Okay, not one. So we have to find funding to pay for this new model of care. And we don't have deep pockets at community clinics. So we have been raising money. We use our FQHC subsidy to help build this care model. And we have been asking many, many other funders to help us fund this model of care as well. So we've gotten about $335,000, but you can see it cost me a whole lot more than that. And so I got a lot of red on the right-hand side. So when Jonathan says, what would I do with this additional money? It would go straight to my care coordination model. And the more I get, the more I'm going to put right in that care coordination model. So that's my fiscal note that I have to bring to my board of directors and have some accountability as well. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them, but thank you for the opportunity for listening to me and worrying about my budget like you're worrying about yours. And we're not sitting idly by. We've been working on this for several years, and we continue and are seeing some very promising results at this point in time with our demonstration project. I know at Cook, I haven't seen all over the system, but we've been able to reach, we've actually reduced our emergency room visits by 10% already, and so we're really excited about that. Yeah. So hopefully it will show some shared savings for us, and we'll be able to maybe use some of that money for our care coordination as well. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, I know you're constrained by time, and you could spend an entire session on this. There's 16 other directors who would love to come and talk. We didn't bring them all today. but I want to point out for members, the kind of stuff that Mr. Watson talked about and the sort of application that you heard here is the very thing that everybody says will improve quality and save money. And this, these 17 clinics are have been starved and starved and leaned up just because of how it goes and DHS reimbursement policies and all, which hamstrings the ability to succeed as we very much want them to do. So that's, of the proposals that are around and the groups that exist that are worthy of engaging with, this is exactly the model that everybody says we should be doing. So,
I know you know that. I was interested that you reduced emergency room visits, because one of the problems around the country is when we've expanded medical assistance, a lot of these people have never gotten their care at any place except an emergency room prior to that. And so they're still going to the emergency rooms first. It sounds like you're taking some steps to have them come to where their primary care really is.
Yes, we are. Actually, yep. We at Cook are, but across the FQHC clinics, the 10 in the demonstration project, we are. And, you know, it's a pretty simple thing at certain times. A lot, you know, the things that we're finding out about people and why they go to the emergency room is, I didn't know that you cared that I went anyplace else. Or, I don't have a thermometer, so I couldn't take my baby's temperature, and so I immediately went to the emergency room. And so, so we just put together like a little brochure to talk to our patients, like when you should go to the emergency room, when you should call us, and when maybe you should go to urgent care, those kind of things. And so a lot of our social workers and our nurses are talking about those sorts of things. So it's really an education process. Now, it doesn't apply for everybody, but that's primarily the reason we're beginning to decrease our emergency room use, is because people are understanding that we care about them, and we want them to come to the clinic and not just run down to the emergency room. So.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just for some clarity, is the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, which is a membership of community clinics, so just for verification, in my district, there's Open Cities. Would that be a member of the association?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, that is correct. There, the Open Cities Health Center is one of the three FQHCs in the St. Paul that are members of our association, in addition to United Family Medicine and Westside Community Health Services. There are 12 FQHCs in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and then we have five in greater Minnesota as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I don't have no data to prove this, but in my mind, just from the observation of whenever I go to the clinic and whenever I'm there for many different reasons, I will predict that community centers play a really vital role in reducing health disparities, because I know there are just the population that I see who are utilizing the clinic are very diverse. And they're one of these entities that is really there to really support preventive care. You have many people who, well, before the Affordable Care Act, now that we have access to everyone having affordable care, they would never turn anyone away. You know, if they were not covered, they would take them in. They also have a sliding fee for those who were not covered by insurance, but it really creates access to health care where other people so often are using the emergency room for preventive care or for care in general. So I think a bill like this, and I just want to thank Representative Abler for bringing this bill forward to really support those community clinics.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen's got a question.
Good.
Mr. Chair, if I should move the amendment. I know we have to move along with the schedule here. So.
Yeah, we have 15 minutes left and two more bills and an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, and then Mr. Schoenbaum will describe it. We tried to lean up, focus more of these SMRC resources on deep rural. We got a little bit too deep with this, so we have to undeepen it.
Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. As Representative Abler said, a few years ago, the legislature changed the definition of a rural area for the state's loan forgiveness program to better focus it on small rural areas. There were some unintended consequences with the definition that we all chose together at that time. The amendment before you fixes that, we hope, or certainly improves it. The connection to the bill before you is that the community of Cook in St. Louis County, population 500, the home of a community health center, a member of Mr. Watson's association, was unintentionally excluded from eligibility in the loan forgiveness program. So we worked with the association and Representative Abler and the health department. We're all in agreement that this would be a better definition.
Any questions or discussions? Representative Leibwin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just curious about whether this was introduced as a bill and whether it should have come to policy.
Representative Abler.
It kind of came at the end, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. It might have, but it came late. And it's it didn't seem, we had done this in 2011, and it was, the definition was a little weak. So it's a pretty small change. And I think minor but important to the town of Cook.
Okay. Just remember, anybody that goes to the canoe area and gets hurt and has to go to a hospital, it's Cook where they go. Grand Marais in Cook County. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, so just so that we all fully understand this, and I hadn't seen the amendment before, but so if we're changing the definition so that somebody can get more loan forgiveness money, that means, of course, that the pot goes further. So I'm kind of wondering, can you just explain a little bit more? I'm not saying I'm opposed to it, but if somebody wins, somebody is losing a little something because it's getting spread further. So could you just explain a little bit more who's getting less in this equation?
Mr. Abler or Mr.
Chairman? I could go, but I'll just short.
And we got to be brief, though, because we're...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, there are no losers in this amendment. It does... It does add some communities that were unintentionally excluded. The loan forgiveness program budget is already oversubscribed, so we already received many more applications than the program can fund. I suppose this does increase the competition a little, but there are no, geographically, there are no losers in the amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the Abler amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the amendment is adopted, and I will lay the bill over for possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
As it was amended.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
And next we have, who do we have here next? Representative Morgan. Or so Patty, you want hers?
Yes.
We'll be out of here. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair.
Please be brief.
Thank you. I'll try. I think I just got kicked off of Representative Fritz's Christmas card list. Mr. Chair, and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to bring forward. Oh, I guess we should move the bill, Mr. Chair. Yes.
I would move House File 2841 before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to bring House File 2841 on behalf of the University of Minnesota AMPLATS Children's Hospital forward today. The purpose of the bill is to provide a technical correction to the original language in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill that was signed into law during the 2011 special session. The intent of the original legislation, as I understand it, was to exempt the state's children's hospitals, including the University Children's Hospital, from the 10% Medicaid rate reduction. I have Carolyn Wilson, who is the president and COO of the hospital, here with me, and she can share a few details about the services they provide.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Morgan, Chair Hutley, and committee members. I'll be very brief. My name is Carolyn Wilson. Proud to serve as president of the University of Minnesota Medical Center and Fairview's chief operating officer. Each day, our academic hospital treats thousands of Minnesotans in our hospital rooms, clinics, emergency room, and surgical suites. In 2011, we brought together all of our children's services into one single location when we opened the University of Minnesota AMPLATS Children's Hospital. This state-of-the-art building is dedicated to children's health care on the west bank of the Mississippi River. Last year, children from all 87 counties in Minnesota sought care at our hospital, including more than $54 million of Medicaid services, more than any other Minnesota children's hospital. Yeah. Our children's hospital features 267 beds in a broad range of programs, including a dedicated pediatric emergency department, six state-of-the-art operating rooms, and a children's observation and sedation unit. We are also proud to have Minnesota's only children's behavioral inpatient unit, programming exclusively dedicated to children 12 and younger. We're also proud of our commitment to the future of medicine. We are a top pediatric research hospital in the upper Midwest and one of the nation's top 20 pediatric research programs, meaning that our doctors apply the most innovative approaches to creating medical breakthroughs based on their work. Our commitment also extends to the future of pediatric medicine in our commitment to education. We offer the largest residency for pediatric program training. We train more than any other children's hospital in Minnesota, 40 MedPeds residents and 71 pediatric residents. Our pediatric students that we train mostly stay in Minnesota, ensuring we have highly trained doctors for future generations of kids. So you can hear we take our threefold mission of clinical care, education, and research seriously. When you look at what we do, we are clearly a children's hospital, and I do not believe we were intended to be left out. And I ask that you add our children's hospital to the list of facilities excluded from the fee-for-service payment reduction. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this was on my watch. And we fully intended to include them, and the fellow who made the paper today who was concerned about this, that's another sidebar story, but it was our intention, and we thought we paid the money out of our extremely lean budget. $3 million was precious at that time, to carve out four children's hospitals, including this one. So that hasn't been interesting to the auditor or to the department as they looked at their work, but it's interesting to me, and I'm trying to get an answer from MMB about where they included this $3 million in the take back in the forecast, and they said, oh, it's in there. Like, well, I don't know where it is. So I hope there's a way to fix this.
Yes.
And I don't know, I would hate to take it out of your budget. I think it should be free. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief. I also am very pleased, Representative. I'm glad to give you the time. This is a very important bill. This is an extremely important bill for the children. And I've toured the hospital. It's outstanding. Thank you for the work that you do there. And we, this not, I cannot believe it was an oversight. So we do need to really take a closer look at this and make sure that they're funded. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Fritz and Representative Abler. I appreciate this. I do want to let the committee know that we are working with DHS. They sent an amendment over to the Senate today. This was heard in the Senate. It didn't honor the 24-hour rule, but we want to continue working with them and with you, the Chair, to clean up any other problems with the language. I think the fiscal analyst just pointed out there's a problem with the retroactive date on the effective date that we could also clean up before, if you did choose to include it in your omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I have actually visited this facility myself, and I think everybody ought to go there. other than the beauty of the place, and it is so family friendly. They have all kinds of facilities around where the kids are, might be in a room where the family can be waiting for the kid and get in to visit the kid, or even just stay with the kid for 24 hours a day if they wish to. So it's a pretty amazing place. With that, I'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I'll keep in touch.
Thank you.
And Representative Fritz.
Yes.
Saving the best for last.
They should have given the cut. They continue to get the rain. And the auditor said a lot of like that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to be brief. This is, I'd like to move the House File 2885 to be included.
Nope, it's got to be transferred to the committee. It should be passed here and referred to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Related Industries.
No. Okay. All right.
And you have an amendment.
I do have an amendment. If I could move that. Okay. The A2 amendment.
She moves the A2 amendment. Could you describe the amendment briefly?
I'd like to just get to what the bill does, or the amendment does. It seeks reimbursement to nursing facilities for the direct and indirect care of raising the minimum wage. The bill provides funding specifically for raising the wages of the workers impacted by the minimum wage. This is important because only the state can increase nursing home rates. So I will now turn it over to Todd Bergstrom and Jeff Bostic.
We have to vote on the amendment.
Okay.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment is adopted.
All right. And I'm just going to turn it over to my two testifiers and be brief. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, members of the committee. Real quickly, you do have an issue paper in front of you that describes the proposal. And as Representative Fritz stated, this addresses the direct and indirect effects of raising the minimum wage to $9.50 for nursing facilities. I think the really important thing to know is that if you look at the front page of that issue paper, there's a map. And what that map shows is that the effect of that is actually varies throughout the state. And so our proposal, what it really is it provides the ability for facilities to submit data to the Department of Human Services based on their employees and their wages and receive a rate increase specific to addressing those wage increases. And I'll turn it over to Jeff to see if he has any comments.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Bostic with Aging Services of Minnesota. We went through a lot of research about the ripple or spillover effect to try and determine kind of what to request in this legislation in terms of a raise to 950, but also some money for people who are around 950 so that they remain kind of ahead of the new minimum wage. So we believe that our bill, at a relatively modest cost to the state, adjusts for the minimum wage and repositions the wage structures of nursing homes individually so that they're prepared to respond to that increase and address the needs of their employees who are below the minimum wage now and those who are close to the new minimum. And we'd be happy to take any questions about how the language was put together and how it works, what it does.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, and thanks, Representative Fritz, for bringing this forward. And if you're going to do minimum wage, you have to do something like this, or you will. The whole 5% thing gets even worse, and we had enough discussion about that. But I also want to remind people that there's those same people that are looking at the direct service professionals and the other long-term care niche are exactly in the same boat, and it seems like that price tag is about three times this one. So for those people who are working on that, please make sure you deal with, and people understand nursing homes better than these other direct professionals, but they're all really important. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know that there's some spillover effect with increasing the minimum wage, but I see that it's targeted to people under $14 an hour, and I haven't been able to really focus on what your amendment did. So could you explain to us kind of like how it will be shared? You know, it isn't necessary that the $7.50 an hour people will go up to $9.50, and then the $10.50 will go up an equivalent amount? Is it up to each facility to decide that? I couldn't quite figure out the math here in the amendment.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. Again, my name is Todd Bergstrom. The way it's designed is, yes, the bill would raise everyone who's below $9.50 up to $9.50, but a lot of the research indicates that that those people who are currently making $9.50, you have to address, you create organizational issues that you need to address. The way it's structured, the reason why it says up to $14 is we didn't want the increase to necessarily address other issues, say for higher paid staff, so it's limited to 14, and there is research that says the spillover goes up to about 140 or 150% of what you raise the minimum wage to. As far as how it's implemented, facilities would need to submit data and a plan as to how the money is distributed up to $14 an hour. And this is kind of the big but, they are able to, within that structure, address those employees who perhaps have the most longevity, perhaps are the most productive, et cetera, to make sure that they address that spillover in the way they see fit.
Thank you. That helps me understand better what's happening. And I would just like to echo and encourage you when you get to the next committee to have an amendment ready for the other long-term care providers and other community providers. I know I heard just from one group home in my area, and it would be a real burden for them in terms of just their awake night staff in terms of their rate increases. And we might as well try. Thanks.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fritz and testifiers. Thanks for thinking about this and bringing this. And I certainly think it's an important issue that we need to deal with. But as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking about some of the nursing homes, even in my own community in Rochester, where they have to pay higher rates because of the market that they're in. And so I don't know, I haven't gone back and asked where what the lowest rates they're paying, but I bet you it's above the minimum wage already because they simply couldn't get people for less because the competition is very stiff with a certain large employer in the neighborhood who can pay a whole lot more. So they have a real, real problem. And I'm just wondering if by doing it in this way, if we aren't sort of discriminating against them because they don't get any higher rates from the state for that situation, and there's a certain squeeze that happens there. So what would I say to them if they should bring that concern to me?
We certainly understand the concerns of all the nursing homes throughout the state in terms of how they, you know, need to compete for labor, and the fact that the inadequate state established rates make that very difficult for them. Mm-hmm. And we certainly would like to see a general rate increase. As far as this bill, this is specifically tailored to address one issue, which is the increase in the minimum wage. So it is not, there will probably be some amount of benefit for everyone because everyone has employees that fall into these classes, but the amount, the way the money is distributed is going to provide help to the people who most need it to deal with the increase to 950, as opposed to other issues which you're also well aware that exist out there.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Liebling's comment about the cost, there are many different programs that do have a uplift for local costs. And also, I join her in that there are other factors such as trying to retain staff that we could have different components. But again, they're not in this bill.
No.
Okay, just a little comment on that there was a time a few years ago when the hospitals in Rochester had to keep people in the hospitals because they could not be discharged to a nursing home because the nursing homes couldn't hire enough people to staff all the beds they had. With that, I would, Representative Fritz, do you want to move your bill and send it off to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Related Industries?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the bill.
Okay. As
amended.
Right. Okay. Well, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Labor, Workplace, and Related Industries.
Good job, you guys.
Thank you. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, members.